going back to special relativity, we studied what would I want to say here? Well, what we did was to say that from the principle of relativity, which is this, which is the idea that all inertial reference frames are equivalent and physics should look the same in all these reference frames. What we found out was that together with some technical hypotheses, this principle directly implied the form of the Lorentz boost. And this form, either in their Lorentzian form or in their Galilean form, which is the limit of C going to infinity. Of course, we will now focus on the on the relativistic case where C is finite and start studying the consequences of this. We have already introduced a few definitions and observations. So first of all, we have introduced the rapidity psi, which is defined as the quantity whose hyperbolic tangent gives V over C. And this was due to the observation that V had to be smaller than C for the factor gamma to be well-defined. And where V is the relative velocity of two inertial systems. So we already know that we cannot perform boosts larger than C. And this is equal to the cosh of psi, which is a number always greater than one. Then we drew this diagram comparing rotations and boosts, once written in terms of the rapidity. Something funny just is that we draw the t-axis towards the top, but it's also the first entry in the vector. So things are a little flipped. Just a matter of getting used to that. So this rapidity is the analog of the angle of a rotation, except that things, instead of being standard trigonometric function, we have hyperbolic trigonometric function, and there is a slight change in sign. The most important relation between these quantities, this one, which is the analog of cos squared plus sine squared equal 1. And the cosh is always larger than 1. And sinh is all can be anything, goes from minus infinity to plus infinity. So the analog, we saw that by looking at the orbit of a point under rotations, we get these circles. And this is the change of reference under a rotation, goes from the axis xy to x prime y prime. Here, the analog picture leads to this hyperbola with the green asymptotes. The green asymptotes are the lines of x equal plus or minus ct, which is called the light cone. Here we do everything with respect to a point, which is our reference point O. In the relativistic language, a point in spacetime in the xt plane here is called an event. So this is a language thing. Points on these planes in spacetime are called events. Then we observe that since velocities are bound to be smaller than c, well, we immediately find that spacetime splits into region. Given any reference point O, the causal past of O, the causal future of O, which define the causal domain. So this is the region of spacetime from which and towards which the event O can receive and send signals. Finally, we also notice that the notion of, I've forgotten to write the new t-axis, okay, t prime. We also observe that the notion of simultaneity is lost in the following sense. events that are simultaneous with respect to the XT frame, which is this horizontal line over here. That these are the events that happen at t equals zero in this frame, are not happening at the same time t prime in the other frame, which is rather described by this red line here. So there is a loss of simultaneity, and this is why I'm not talking about the present of O, because it doesn't make sense. It's rather, it gets all blurred into this big region over here. Okay, this is the recap of last time. Any questions about this? Now, the next thing that I want to do is to recover quickly the formula for the addition of velocities. The picture is the following. We have three reference frames. Implicitly, they are all inertial, of course. We have k, k prime, and k second, double prime. So k2 is moving with respect to k prime with velocity v2, and k1 is moving with respect to k at velocity v1. K2, what we want to understand is what is this velocity v3. Now, so this means that to go from here to there, I need to do a boost of velocity v1 and so on. So how do we go about this? Well, we just need to compose two of these boosts. So we know that we do a boost to go from k to k prime, then we do one from k prime to k double prime, and this will be some boost that takes us from k to k second. By computing, so this is essentially what I mean by psi 3, and it is like rotations are additive in theta. All this hyperbolic trigonometry tells us that boosts are additive in psi, which doesn't mean that they're additive in V, of course. So this tells us that the hyperbolic tangent of P3 is the hyperbolic tangent of psi 1 plus psi 2, which is equal to sinh of psi 1 plus psi 2 divided by cosh of psi 1 plus psi 2. And I didn't want to take so much space, but I suppose that's life. This is sinh psi 1 sinh psi 2 plus cosh psi 1 cosh psi 2 divided by sinh psi 1 cosh psi 2 plus cosh psi 1 sinh psi 2. Okay, this looks like not much, but of course we want hyperbolic tangents to appear, so we divide everything by, for example,
what do we want? The product of the two sinh.
No, wait, just a second.
I mixed up. Of course I mixed up. So this is like this. Okay. Now it makes more sense. So it's sinh and cosh at the top, and sinh, cosh down here. I divide by the product of the sinh, and I find this, the two hyperbolic tangents over here, psi 1 plus psi 2, 1 plus the product. So this is the standard formula. And finally, now we can write V1 plus V2, 1 plus V1, V2. Over C squared.
So this is the famous formula for the addition of velocities.
Well, there are over C's everywhere, so C and C.
So that's it. It was super easy to find in using this trigonometry, and it's easy also to see that So another way to think about this formula, instead of being the composition of two boosts, I can think of it in the following way. Suppose I have an object at rest in K2, and it's moving with speed. It means that it's an object that moves at speed V2 in K prime. So this is like asking an object that moves at speed V2 in K prime, how is it seen moving from the perspective of V1, and this is also another way to think about this formula. Finally, the last comment is the following. So an object moving at speed U in K prime is seen moving at speed v equal, sorry, u prime in k prime. What do I want this? Is seen moving at velocity u equal u prime plus v divided. Here I'm changing slightly notation. I will say in a second what I mean by this. If k prime speed in, or I can say it's q, k, q, q, in, it's prime in K, if K prime moves at speed V with respect to K. Okay. Vice versa, one can write U prime is equal to U minus V divided by 1 plus UV C squared. So one can check that this is indeed the inverse of this formula. Just it can be just obtained by flipping the sign of V up there. Oops. And down here. Okay. Now what happens if the object is moving at speed C? We know that we cannot perform boosts of speed C, but we can let's suppose there is an object moving at speed C in one frame. And see at which speed is moving in the original frame. Then it's an easy computation to show that C is a fixed point of this transformation. U equals C is a fixed point of this formula. C is a universal velocity.
which we could have guessed because objects moving at speed c are moving along these lines, and these lines look the same in all frames. So we already knew it from the picture, but it's good to see it in the formula. Okay, so this is all fairly standard. Now what we want to do is to we saw what happens to speeds of moving objects when we change frames. Now we want to understand what happens to length of moving objects. Any question about speed, the speed addition formula or speed composition formula? So we have, let's say we have a rod at rest in reference
k prime,
and k prime moves at velocity u with respect to k. The rod length in k prime is L, little l, which is called the proper length. So whenever you see the word proper in special relativity, it means that is that quantity computed in the resting frame of the object. So, because this is a universal way of defining something, right? You have an object. You don't care how it's moving, etc. You go in its own instantaneous reference frame, and you say you measure it, and that's a it's a well-defined procedure that fixes whatever number you care about. So now we want to see how it looks in the reference k. So let's first do it graphically, which is it's a nice way of doing things. So we have. We start from the reference, the prime reference in this case, where the rod is at rest. So how does it look, a rod at rest in a certain frame? Well, it will move one end of the rod, let's say, is this line at x equals 0, x prime equals 0, which moves in time. And then we have another line over here, which is the other end of the rod moving fixed down here at x prime equal b. Now we draw the moving frame. The moving frame, if k prime is moving at velocity u with respect to k, k is moving with respect to k prime at velocity minus u. So it will be something like this. Ct, where this is the velocity u, right? Okay. Next, so why this is interesting? Because how do we define this? Forces us to ask, how is length defined? Length in reference k is defined as xb minus xa at fixed time, right? So we take a line of fixed time and we look at this, we're asking which coordinate xb
I'm putting here if this is x b prime. Right? So we have xa will be 0, so we're essentially asking what will be xb. So now we go back to that picture, and our reference length, our way to carry length from one frame to the other is, in this case, is the radial distance from the origin. In that case, is this hyperbolic distance from the origin. So I should have written it up there, but I forgot. So this line over here is an hyperbola. Described by, so let's see, x squared minus ct squared. Well, I should maybe write it the other way around. C squared ct squared minus x squared equals minus l squared. Of fixed, for a fixed value l. And this comes, of course, from this formula down here. If you look at it. So now, if I want to know how long this is, I can't just read it by saying, oh, this xb is the same xb prime, or maybe here, this looks longer. No, what I need to do to carry on distances on an hyperbolic plane is to draw a hyperbola. So the hyperbola going through here will look like that. So it turns out that the distance L will be shorter than the distance L prime. So from the graph, L is less than L prime equal L. Is this graph clear to everybody? It takes a little thought. If you've never used these graphs, this is normal. Okay, so let's try to now we can also use the graph to compute the answer of what L is. So L, we said, is this distance, which can be computed as follows. L squared is equal to, let's put the minus sign, which is compatible with my future conventions. So this is TB XB squared, but is also CT prime. What do I want to? So maybe I want to call this, T prime. Let's call this, prime. Let me call this point B. That's what I really want to, let me just call that point B. So we have C prime, T prime, square minus XB square. So whether I compute it in one frame or another, now I'm getting confused myself. Doesn't matter. So we know that TB by definition is zero. So this is by definition zero, and this is by definition L squared. Right, which is what we're given on this side. Now we know uh, we know that this is little l. And what is this one? Well, this one is this distance here. We know that this is an angle. Well, if this line is drawn such that one frame moves with respect to the other at speed u. So this is c. I'm confusing myself, which is normal. U over okay, let me write it like this. Tangent of psi L. So we get that L square is equal to 1 minus tangent square of psi L square, but this is 1 over cosh square of psi L square, which was gamma square u L square. So, and I'm getting it the other. No, sorry. This is a typo in my notes. So cosh is the quantity larger than one, which is gamma itself. So okay. So now L square, and this is the answer. Okay. Okay. Now it makes sense.
Yeah. The
hyperbolic length is okay. So here I notice that my when I perform a boost, coordinate change with this matrix. This cosh and sinh have this. So I see these first as just a change of coordinates, of variables from v to gamma to psi, and then I know that cosh square psi minus sinh square psi is a constant. So this means that in the same way, all these quantities are on at a fixed distance from the center, which I can compute in every possible frame, which is given by x squared plus y squared in any possible coordinate system, which is due to the fact that cos squared plus sin squared is 1. Here, in the same manner, all points on this hyperbola are on a line described by t squared minus x squared equal a constant. And I can put primes, and it would stay true, because it's really the same thing as here, so except that there is this minus sign, but nothing else changes. Yeah, and and this time here is the time that it takes to get there, moving at speed u, moving a distance xb at speed u. That's why it's this ratio u over l of, let me see. That's how this coordinate is found. Thank you. is proportional to u and to x. And one has to divide by. Because this is how I define the length in the reference k, is the coordinate distance from the origin, but along the line at fixed time. So by definition, this must be zero, and this by definition is the length in that frame. Yeah, had it here. Oh, here there is a minus sign, which is because it's going minus. Well, depends, on the sign of s e squared, so it doesn't really matter. Okay, so there is a typo which I need to correct. So one can. So this is called the Lorentz Fitzgerald contraction. And there is also Lorentz Fitzgerald dilation of time, which I will not do in the class. Will be a tutorial. And there are a couple of ways to perform that computation. And it also forces us to understand how we define time. So here we define length by saying, oh, it's the coordinate distance between the two ends at a fixed time in that frame. So there we will have to find a way to define a notion of time, which translates well in different frames. But I will put it as a guided exercise in a tutorial. And so if there are questions, we will discuss them there. Now I want to move. So let me just mention the result. Let me see how I wrote it. So gamma u tau, so tau is the proper time interval, which is the time interval in the rest frame of a certain clock. So is, and this is the time in the frame k. So this is, if we want, there is a moving clock in the frame k prime. The story is the same, except that instead of looking at a rod, we look at the moving clock. And we look at how much time it looks like it elapses in the rest frame and in the moving frame. So it goes with the opposite factor. So this is a time dilation form. One nice thing of the way we will deduce time dilation is that we can use it to deduce that transverse length do not change during under boosts. So here we are working in one dimension. So there is only one direction, and this is the direction in which we perform our boosts. But what about length in the transverse direction with respect to the one we perform boost? Well, those do not change. So this is, if I want to be more precise, this is L parallel, because L perpendicular does not change. And this can be seen as a consequence of these two formulas. So for consistency, one needs L perpendicular to be constant. And this is in the notes, but we will also do it more slowly in a tutorial. So I will leave it for there. The result is quite... Is there anybody who has never seen a time dilation? Just to make sure that... OK, so. OK, so now we go to something a little bit more abstract. So we worked here in one dimension, in 1 + 1 dimensions, where Lorentz transformations just looks more or less like rotations. Now we want to have an understanding of how things work in higher dimensions. So instead of writing things by hand, I want to make things a little bit more abstract and introduce a few concepts and use these to understand the Lorentz group in dimension 3 + 1. So let's start from the definition of a group. So what is a group? A group G is a set. Well, a group is a set G together with a map from G to G into G, which takes G1 and G2 and sends it to a new element, G3, which is denoted G2, G1. And this map is called a multiplication. And which axioms we want this to satisfy? Well, we want it to be associative. Two, there exists a unique identity element. One, or unit element, maybe unit, which says that G that they can multiply with anything and obtain and gives back the same element, whereas associativity says G1, G2, G3 is the same as G1, G2, G3. And three, we want the inverses to exist. Every element, all G, has a unique inverse. G minus 1, G, G, G minus 1 is equal to 1. So there is a unique inverse. Every G has unique inverse G minus 1 that does that. OK, is this familiar? Fairly? So now we define a Lie algebra. We have already seen it in the context of the Poisson bracket and the Lie algebra of vector fields. But let me remind you what this is. So a Lie algebra A
is a vector space. Lie algebra is a vector space. Is a vector space A together with an operation, a map from A cross A into A.
So it's a, again, a sort of multiplication that sends A1, A2 to, oops, A1
to A3, denoted A1, A2,
such that
well, we have three properties. First one is that the bracket is bilinear
in R or C if we want the complex Lie algebra, but we will work in R.
Skew symmetric
and satisfies Jacobi.
So this says that A1, A2 is equal to A1, sorry, mine. And this is the cyclical identity, A3 plus cyclical permutation is equal to 0.
So so now these two look slightly, well, I try to write them in parallel, but there is, it's not that one corresponds to one, two corresponds to two, and three corresponds to three. The thing one can say is that Jacobi essentially comes from the associativity of the group multiplication. We will see how to go from a group to an algebra in a moment. So this was more. Now, the remark, of course, is that both rotations and Lorentz transformations in one in one plus one are certainly groups. And we used it already implicitly when we say that there is a psi 3 such that lambda psi 2 times lambda psi 1 is lambda psi 3, right? So this is the existence of a multiplication over there. So now we want to define our 2D Lorentz group in an abstract manner. So one can prove that
so the warm up is about.
The warm up is rotations once again, just to show that the parallel between these definitions and the differences.
So, see, 2D rotations form a group defined by the following properties, defined as the group of transformations such that of R2, sorry, of linear transformations of R2
such that they leave
the Euclidean norm invariant. Which is exactly the statement we saw before, which is x prime squared plus y prime squared is equal to x squared plus y squared,
where x prime, y prime are the transform coordinates. And two, they have unit determinants. That is, they do not flip the orientation of R2.
Well, they preserve, let's say positively, preserve the orientation.
It's an exercise which is maybe which takes a few steps to prove that from these two properties one can deduce that rotations take that form. There must exist a theta such that R as a matrix from R2 to R2 takes that form. And the proof is in the notes. And it's instructive because generalizing it to the Minkowski, to the Lorentz group is possible, but it requires an extra hypothesis, which we'll now make clear.
So we have the 2D, well, let's call them 1 plus 1 dimensional boosts, form a group. G, we call it S, O. Well, I will explain the notation in a moment. S, O plus 1, 1. And I will say the plus what refers to. Defined as the group of linear transformations of R2. Such that, okay, what are our axioms? They do not leave the Euclidean norm invariant, but the Minkowskian norm. Invariant, and this is with a minus between x and t. So in my conventions, the interval is defined in this way, with a positive on the time and negative on space. So this is called the interval and is called S squared, even though it can be either positive or negative. So it's just a symbol as is. So it's not the square of a real number. M2, we want them to have unit determinant. M3, this is not enough. We also want them to preserve the direction of time. Which means that lambda 0, 0, which is the component up here of my transformation, the time-time component, if you want, lambda time-time, is positive. So this here is O2. And the unit determinant is the S. So these are special orthogonal transformation of R2. This is how to read this name. Special refers to the unit determinant condition, and orthogonality refers to the fact that it preserves the Euclidean norm. Here, we have a similar situation. We have the fact that we want to preserve a Minkowskian norm, and this is the condition O11,
1, 1 refers to the signature of this. There is one positive sign and one negative sign. And then we have the determinant, the unit determinant condition. We say that these are special orthogonal transformation. And this is not enough. We need the third one, which is this plus over here. And these are called, is the orthochronicity condition. So one can therefore generalize the Lorentz group in a couple of ways by relaxing these two conditions over here. So let me say a couple of words. So I will call the Lorentz group usually the proper orthochronous Lorentz group, but this is the most general set of transformations that generates, that preserves the Minkowski norm. Then we have SO11 are called the proper Lorentz transformation, I think. Should be Lorentz group. What they can do is that, for example, they have this strange property. Well, they're not, I would say these are not super interesting per se. They can flip space and time at the same together. So they are, this is the most intuitive one, maybe, proper orthochronous Lorentz transformations. And an element in 011 can be written as lambda. Is either lambda or lambda times p or lambda times t or lambda times pt. So lambda is an element here of SO plus 11, like those we have written. And what are p and t? P flips parity, so it's something that preserves time and flips parity here. So it's a mirror image of, in 2D it looks like this. And time, this one flips time, the orientation of time. So this one here is element which are either lambda or lambda pt together. Should have done it in red. So in red we have, and these are g's in SO11. So the idea is that the full Lorentz group that preserve, defined as just the object that preserve the Minkowski norm, are those that we studied so far, which should be called the proper orthochronous Lorentz transformation, which is a bit lengthy. And since we will focus only on those in this course, I will just call them Lorentz transformations or Lorentz boosts. But in general, there is more to the set of transformations that preserve this norm, which is one can add transformations that flip the parity or time. And these are these parity transformation P and time reversal transformation T. So they,
So lambda T is not linear to orthogonous.
No. So these are, lambda is an element of that form that I've written with the Cauchy and the Singe. One can then multiply that transformation by something that flips the orientation of space and obtain another element that preserves this norm, of course, but is not part of the, is not of that form anymore. It has some minus signs. And same thing for T. If I do P and T together, I still get transformation with unit determinant, but at the price of having flipped both time and space. So in quantum field theory, PT is an important symmetry taken together. Or with the charge conjugation is CPT symmetry. So that's why it's important to know that these things exist. Okay, next. Any questions about this? Yes.
Were you writing the gender inverse for the quantum field theory?
Sorry?
Were you writing the gender inverse for the
quantum field? Oh, these. These are depends what you mean by generators. So any element in here can be written as an element in the proper orthochronous one, time separity or time reversal transformation. That's what I mean. Any element in here can, it's either an element in SO in the proper orthochronous one or a product of that element with either parity or, so maybe, let me write it slightly differently. Hopefully it's a bit clearer. So we have lambda, lambda pt, lambda p, lambda t. So this is SO plus 1, 1. This one here is SO 1, 1. And the big one is O 1, 1. If that makes more sense. Yeah. Okay. Now from here, it's easy to generalize to higher dimensions because it's quite obvious what we want to happen if there are more space than a special direction. Here we just make these, we add z, and here we take x and just put a little arrow on top and we find what happens in general dimensions. So instead, all the space directions must behave in the same manner because we have isotropy. So it's a consequence of isotropy that the right generalization of space is ct squared minus x squared, and then we keep m1, m2, and m3, and we see what happens. So this is what I want to do now. In 1 plus 3 dimension, we introduce this matrix, which is the Minkowski metric. And we introduce the Minkowski norm. Just for, well, let's call it just x, that's fine. So this is the Minkowski norm. On R4, Minkowski, it's not a norm in the sense, it's not positive definite, so one has to be careful about that, and again, I put my minus sign on, sorry, I'm flipping things. The minus is on time, not on space. I was confusing myself. Okay. Okay, so I think in quantum field theory, you will use the opposite signature. In general relativity, usually one keeps this one, this one that I've written here, it's, yeah, you will have to navigate this annoyance. Now, one observation is that,
So this is equal to minus ct squared plus the norm,
the spatial norm of the vector, right?
So if x is ct x, like this.
Okay.
Now we define the Lorentz group, the proper orthochronous Lorentz group, to be the group that preserves this norm, as by as before. Except that we replace M1 with this formula over here. Replaced by star, which is the general dimension. We could also say that M1 then becomes, which is equivalent to saying the following, lambda transpose eta lambda is equal to eta. If this is true for every choice of x, I can just say that what I really want, without any reference to the vector, is that lambda is a matrix that preserves the form of this matrix, right? So what is the analog of this in for rotations? This matrix is the identity, so we want the transpose of a rotation times the rotation is equal to 1. It means that the transpose is the inverse of the matrix. So this is the usual orthogonality condition for matrices. So this generalizes to this signature the concept of rotations in that way. When x this, this is M1, M2 and M3 don't change. And M2 says the determinant of lambda is 1. And in fact, this already implies that the determinant must be plus or minus 1. So this fixes the sign only. And the this is M2 and M3 is lambda 0, 0. So the time component must be positive. Is it clear why this one implies already that the determinant must be plus or minus 1? Because we take the determinant of this by the Binet formula. This is the determinant of the product of the determinants. The product the determinants of etas cancels. And we find that the determinant of the transpose is the same as the determinant of the matrix. So the determinant of the matrix square is 1, which says that the determinant is plus or minus 1. And here we are fixing it to be plus 1. And M3 is the fact that the time direction is never flipped. So now we know that, thanks to this property, we know that we can compute this quantity in any frame, and it will stay the same. And so we give names to the axes. Since these are different signs, we give names to axes such that their norm with respect to eta is either positive or negative. So this you have for sure already seen, but we say that x is said space-like, time-like, or null or light-like if is space-like is positive. It means that the space component wins. In particular, it means that there exists a frame in which this type component vanishes, time-like, and null. So in that graph, there are those pointing to the sides of the light cone, into the light cone, and along the light cone. Good. So now we want to, look at, so now we, what we want to do is to use the main equation over there, which is the fact that the Lorentz transformation preserves the Minkowski metric, to deduce information about these matrices. In particular, it should be, let me also do another simple observation before moving on. A simple observation is the following. Lambdas of the form 1 are Lorentz transformation with this rotation are Lorentz transformation. Right, so rotations are Lorentz transformations. And it turns out, so this tells us, so how many, in particular, it tells us that the group of rotations is a subgroup of the group of Lorentz transformations. Now, how many such subgroups there are? So the thing I would like to emphasize is that so SO 3 is a subset of SO plus 1 3, but there are many ways of talking about rotations. There is not just one notion of rotations, and there is one notion of rotation for each inertial frame. So we have said that the notion of simultaneity, so how we assign a notion of space, depends on which frame you're in. So depending on which frame you're in, we're talking about different rotations. And how do we see it in here? Well, we know that we have that the set lambda r, lambda minus 1, 4, Let me call this rho of r. For lambda fixed and r a rotation. Well, so the set of these matrices also forms a rotation subgroup of SO13, and this is isomorphic to SO3. What do we mean by this? We mean that if we have, let's call this lambda, so we have that R1 rho lambda R2 is equal to what? Lambda rho of R, lambda minus 1, lambda rho R2, lambda. And this is equal to lambda rho of R1, lambda rho of R2. And this clearly is rho of the product. I'm forgetting my minus ones. And this is, again, that. So this means that there are many ways of talking about the group of rotation inside the Lorentz group, depending on which reference frame we choose. And this is how we can think of this lambda as changing our reference frame, performing the standard rotation in that frame, and then going back. So for every reference frame, there is a notion of rotations. And this is the mathematical way of seeing this. This is, of course, this is not, this is a rather simple observation, but
if you study, for example, the BMS group, something similar happens and there is a little bit more confusing or more subtle, but it's a similar situation where you have, I don't know if these words make sense to you, but you have this BMS group is a group of symmetries of general relativity at from the perspective of infinity, in a way. And there, instead of having a Lorentz group, it happens to that the Lorentz group is extended by what is known as supertranslations. And supertranslations, So for every choice of supertranslation, there is a Lorentz subgroup inside this bigger group, which is called BMS. And the mechanism is similar. So this is just to emphasize this idea that although there is a natural way of thinking about a subgroup inside another group, one can always find, there are usually more ways obtained by conjugating the standard way of looking at the subgroup by an element of the group. So this is a very general fact. I have a subgroup, but this embedding usually is not. There is one that looks most natural often, but is not unique. There are many ways of doing this. These are all rotation group, but in different frames. Now the idea is to, so far we have talked about the Lorentz group. Of course, the idea is to study its Lie algebra. And the idea to study its Lie algebra is because usually the algebra is simpler to deal with than the group itself. So we start from an observation. Yes. Yes. Oh, these lambdas are four. So before we were working in two dimensions. Now we are saying, oh, what happens in higher? So it's a 4x4 matrix that's, yeah, conjugated with that. Yeah. So this is 4x4, and this must be also 4x4.
And what does it mean when you write the
0? Oh, right, sorry. So these, by convention, the time component is the zero component. So this is the top left corner of the matrix. Yeah, so lambda is lambda 0, 0, lambda 0, 1, lambda 0, 2, lambda 0, 3, lambda 1, 0, etc. And these are the lambda ij, if you will. Okay. With. Yeah, sorry about that. I should have mentioned. In the old literature, it was x4, and I think that's why we put it first the time. I don't know. It makes sense that it goes up there, but so in some literature, in the older literature, one doesn't use the zero. One uses the four, but. The zero is what is now most common. So A, rotation, subgroup. So the observation is that I can take my 2x2 lambda psi, so lambda psi, as I def psi 1, can be written in the following manner. So let me Taylor expand in psi. It starts with 1, 0, 0. The cosh starts with 1, and the sinh starts with 0. Then we have psi. Let me do it like this. Why I put minus signs? This is a bit strange.
So this is 0 psi, psi 0, plus 1, 2 factorial psi square, 0, 0, 1, 2 factorial psi square, plus 0, 1, 3 factorial psi cube, etc. So now we introduce the matrix K. So we see that this is either proportional to the identity or to this matrix with the opposite, with the anti-diagonal, ones on the anti-diagonal. And we observe also that, so this is K times psi. We would like this to be K squared times psi square. So, and in fact, this is the case because K squared is the identity. So this is a definition. And then I see that lambda psi can be written as the sum from K from 0 to infinity of psi K, K fact, well, maybe N, to not have too many k's, psi to the n, n factorial, and k to the n factorial. And this I define to be the exponential of my matrix K. So does this, so this is, I'm just defining the exponential through its Taylor expansion. And I don't care that this is a matrix. If I have doubts of what this means, I go back to the definition over here. So this is what I mean by the exponential of a matrix. And the same I could do for rotations. So for rotations, okay, let's do it.
This is for Lorentz.
Yeah. In
2D. There should be the minus with this.
Yeah, there I didn't put it. Maybe I should have put it there. Let's see. X.
I mean, it's.
Well, it's consistent with my draw. I have different parts of the notes. I'm afraid I'm using different different conventions. It doesn't. Why do you want a minus? Maybe you're right. I'm confused by my own notes.
I think it follows from the definition.
For example,
you have x prime is equal to x minus
a. No, either you don't, you have to put it, if you put a minus, you have to put it in front both sinh. So I think what I've done on the blackboard so far is consistent because the determinant of that matrix is cosh square minus sinh square, and that's one. Whereas in the other case, you want to flip the sign. That's why there's a minus. It's not enough to put the cos into a cosh and a sin into a sinh. There is also a sign difference. That's correct. Look, if just compute the determinant of those two matrices, they both give determinant 1, and that's the check.
That's the check. OK.
So for rotations, I leave it as an exercise.
R theta is equal to x of
theta j
with j
essentially the infinitesimal form of that rotation becomes 1. So this will be the identity plus theta j plus the rest of the Taylor expansion. So
But just by looking at r theta, developing it in powers of theta, I look at the linear term, and this gives me j. So this is minus 1, 0. And I can check that this minus 1, if I take j squared, it will start flipping around. So j squared is minus 1. And this is giving me the difference in signs in the expansion of a cosh versus that of a cos, for example. So, yes? Sorry?
Is it supposed to be the exponential of pi?
No. No, otherwise you would get i's here. And I don't see any I in my matrix over there. But every odd term would have i's in it. So if you want, you can put an i here and an i also there. But there's no need to do that. Okay. So if you compute, just do the exercise and you will see that it works. Okay, so okay, now what do we want to do? Now, this will be useful in a moment. What we want to do is to generalize, to find a way to generalize this just by looking at this formula over here. So what we could, so this is, sorry, what I wanted to say that from this infinitesimal, by studying the infinitesimal version of a Lorentz boost or a rotation, I can recover the entire matrix. This is what this little exercise is about. Now we want to do the same in higher dimensions and find out, so in higher dimensions, we want to write lambda equal to the exponential of some little lambda, and we want to times epsilon, and this will be 1 plus epsilon lambda plus epsilon squared over 2 factorial lambda squared, etc. And as usual, we stop at first order and check what happens, for example, to this defining equation, to this equation, and so on. And thereby, we will extract the analog of these j and k in higher dimensions. So I will not have the time to do it, but now we want to study lambda t equal lambda eta at order epsilon, and thereby understand the form of lambda in analogy with k and j from the previous exercise, from previous example. So this is what we want to do. I just write one more equation, and then I stop, and we do the rest next time. Let me develop this. So this is 1 plus epsilon lambda transposed eta 1 plus epsilon lambda equal eta. So at order epsilon, this becomes eta and eta simplify. So we get that lambda transpose eta plus eta lambda must be zero.
So this is condition M1 at the level of the algebra, in fact, at the infinitesimal level. So lambda so for a very small Lorentz transformation, instead of having to satisfy this finite condition, it has to satisfy, in a sense, this infinitesimal condition. So let's look at what happens if we were looking at rotations. In that case, eta would be the identity. So we have the transpose plus the matrix is equal to zero, which means that the matrix is antisymmetric, which is exactly what is happening for rotations over here. Okay, so this is a sanity check, in a way, that what we're doing makes sense. Okay, so next time we will find a basis that solves this equation. It's quite simple, and we will see that it's essentially a generalization of these J's and K's in 3+1 dimensions, and then we will go from there. Yes. So, I'm trying to think of a way to phrase these generators are defined as the linear order of these matrices. So in a sense, it's a definition. One could rephrase the question maybe by asking why this is enough to understand the structure of the entire group. And the reason, in a way, is similar to what we were arguing the other day about vector fields and Hamiltonian vector fields. You can understand. So these infinitesimal, this first order is a little like studying vector. Well, it's not a little. It's pretty much like studying vector fields. So a vector field is infinitesimal first order symmetry, in a way, over a certain space. And by integrating the flow of the vector field, I can find the finite transformation. And here is the very same thing, in fact. If one can study these type of groups, which are called Lie groups, that depend on a continuous set of parameters, they are, in fact, not just sets, they are manifolds. On these manifolds, one can consider vector fields, and in particular, the vector fields generated by the action of the group on itself. And these vector fields correspond to these infinitesimal elements. So there is a geometrical theory of these types of groups that makes rigorous this analogy that I mentioned. So the analogy, just to repeat it, is the first order approximation of this group element is the same thing as saying I have a finite transformation. Like if you want a finite canonical transformation, because that's what we were looking at, or a finite symmetry, and I look at the infinitesimal version of this symmetry, and this infinitesimal version defines for me a vector field over, for example, phase space or configuration space, and the flow line, they integrate in the flow of these vector fields, allows me to recover from the infinitesimal version of the symmetry the finite version of the symmetry, following where at each step the infinitesimal transformation brings me. So another way of seeing this is this other formula for the exponential. So you know that exponential of x is the limit for n that goes to infinity of 1 minus x over n, plus.
No, minus. To the n.
Right.
And now, what is this? No, maybe, is that correct? No, 1 to plus. So this is, in fact, an infinite product. So this is so I'm taking infinitesimal steps of order x over n and composing them after each other. So this is how a pictorial way of how you integrate this flow, in fact. You take an infinitesimal version, and you repeat it, you compound it on top of itself. Yeah.
So are you just a version that you know that the transformation is continuous and that recomposes in this way, and that's how we can argue that it has this exponential form?
Yeah. Now, probably erased it, but there were many types of, well, not many types, but there was the proper Orthochronos-Lorentz group, and then there were these other versions of it. A parity transformation is a discrete symmetry, is flipping something. So this cannot be described in terms of these infinitesimal versions. So in fact, these infinitesimal analyses, at best, will recover the proper Orthochronos-Lorentz group, which and in this case is exactly true. At times, you might not recover the entire, well, it's a bit more delicate. So what you can recover the full group by from the knowledge of the infinitesimal transformations, but sometimes exponentiating like this might not be enough. But this is a quite subtle problem. We will ignore. It's not something that you usually have to worry about. So is a for the Lorentz group, this doesn't happen. Or rotations, this doesn't happen. Whichever element in the group can be expressed as an exponential. In different cases, you might have to consider product of exponentials. But that's as much as bad as it gets, essentially. So is the logic clear about why we're looking into this infinitesimal version and trying to study the... You see, the advantage is that this is a nonlinear equation, so it's a bit of a mess. This one is a linear equation and will be very easy to solve in full generality. So that's where we gain something, and then all the nonlinearities will be packaged into taking these exponentials, and we hope to not really have to do it most of the time. So for the Noether theorem also, we just cared about the infinitesimal version. So these infinitesimal symmetries still contain most of the information that we care about. So that's another motivation to look at the generators.